Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When I put my creative hat back on, I knew that I had changed, and I knew that I had no interest in reopening the same 11 Madison Park as before.
Hello, this is Martha Stewart, and this is my podcast. And following is probably the longest introduction of any of my podcasts to date. First Michelin star at age 24. The number one restaurant in the world. More than a decade of three Michelin stars. Chef Daniel Hume has earned the highest accolades in the culinary world. He is the ambitious chef at the helm of 11 Madison Park, a fine dining restaurant in the Flatiron District in New York City. 11 Madison Park turned 25 years old this month, and Chef Hume is here to talk to us today about its history and the distinct ways in which it has evolved, including its most radical reinvention to date as an entirely plant-based restaurant. Welcome to my podcast, Daniel
Thank
Hume.
You so much, Martha.
Chef Hume. I'm going to call you Chef. Well, you just celebrated the 25th anniversary of your beautiful restaurant, 11 Madison Park. Congratulations. Can you tell us a little bit about the history, about Danny Meyer and the beginning of this iconic restaurant?
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. The restaurant opened in 1998. Before me, Danny Meyer opened the restaurant. And as you said, it's in the Flatiron District, and it's right adjacent to Madison Square Park. And it was quite visionary at that time to open a restaurant in that location, because Madison Square Park wasn't what it is today. Today, it's a beautiful park, but back then it was quite dilapidated. And that whole area wasn't what it was today. And that's, I think, the beauty to see how a restaurant actually can change a neighborhood. And I think Danny Meyer deserves a lot of credit for that. I think he has done that in a lot of places in New York City. He opened the restaurant as a brasserie. The restaurant is located in a historical building. The building was meant to become the tallest building in the world. It was built in 1928. Then the Great Depression hit. They ran out of money, and just the build was halted. Actually, the building is an entire city block large, but it only is 30 stories tall, and it was meant to be over 100. But what we ended up with is these gigantic arches for the entrance of the restaurant. Even the the lobby, which is where our restaurant is located, the scale is as if you would be in the tallest building in the world. So we're the beneficiary of those scales.
It's so amazing to walk into that restaurant and feel so surrounded by very tall ceilings, unlike any other restaurant, and so luxurious in architecture.
I mean, for me, when I first stepped foot into the restaurant, I just knew that I had entered one of the most beautiful restaurant spaces I've ever seen or ever been in. And it was clear that it had the potential to be something very, very special.
And who was the chef when Danny Meyer opened the restaurant?
The chef was Kerry Heffernan, and he was the opening chef, and he remained the chef until I joined.
And you joined in what year?
I started in 2006, in January 2006. I was briefly in San Francisco for 2 years before coming there from Switzerland, where I grew up. Yeah, I've been there also 18 years in the 25-year history.
And an amazing 18 years it has been. You do not, you're like the Rolling Stone. You don't get covered in any moss anywhere, boy. You evolve and evolve and evolve and change. And so great. I love that about you.
Thank you so much.
So what are you doing to celebrate the 25th anniversary? Are you eating silver? Have you figured out a way to cook silver?
No, we actually, you know, it was an interesting question. I mean, we created a menu that is a retrospective and pays homage to all these years and all these. There's been many different chapters along the way, and you know, as you said, we turned the restaurant into fully plant based after the pandemic, almost 3 years ago now. And the big question was, you know, are we going to cook the fish and meat dishes from the past to pay tribute? But our team felt very strongly that no, we are now, you know, fully committed to this plant-based journey.
So don't go there looking for duck.
No, the duck won't be there. But what it was interesting, even as a refresher for us, it was to see that, you know, this actually didn't happen overnight. We always were creative with vegetables, and we always loved to really push vegetables to the foreground. Even there's a dish that is the carrot tartare, and this dish was created in 2010. And at that time, we knew we wanted to be an iconic New York City restaurant. So we studied the iconic restaurants like the 21 Club or the Four Seasons restaurant or the Delmonico's. And what we saw is that they all had a version on a steak tartare on their menu. So we're like, well, we also need one. And for like a year, we worked on that dish, and we worked with different dry-aged beef and venison and all kinds of things. And we just couldn't figure out how we would add something new to this dish. And after like a year, we knew that we wanted to grind the meat table size in one of those old school grinders, but we couldn't figure it out. And then one day I spent time in Warwick, New York, upstate, and I spent time with this farmer, Alex Paffenroth, who is like a master in growing carrots. And he talked my ears off for an entire day about the sweet carrot, about the meaty carrot, about the acidic carrot. And so by the time I came back to the restaurant that night, and we were having another sort of like R&D session, and I looked at the carrots and I looked at the meat, and it was just clear that the best version on a steak tartare, even in our eyes, even in 2010, what ended up actually being carrots. The carrot tartare. So this has been sort of like long in the making.
Guess what I just had the other night?
Tell me.
I had beet tartare.
Oh my God.
At the Stone Barns.
Amazing.
And it was incredibly delicious. And it's their new beet. They have just developed a new beet. You know, they develop hybrids of all kinds of vegetables. And this kind of red, light red beet tastes just like steak tartare.
Oh, beautiful.
And it was wonderful. And so here I'm coming back to taste the yes. the 2011 carrot tartare.
Yes, definitely.
Oh, so what's in it?
I just wanted to also give a shout out to Dan Barber at Stone Barns. I think he's a real pioneer in growing and cooking with vegetables. And
oh, yeah.
I have so much respect for him. He's done an
incredible job at Stone Barns. I mean, it's hard for me to eat real steak tartare now after tasting the beet. And I want to taste your carrot. I have beautiful big carrots in my garden. What kind of carrots should we be using? Old carrots, new carrots?
We use this like French carrot called Charente.
Yeah. Oh, I have that. I have that one.
And that to me, that is like the best for this dish.
But does it matter if the carrots are like a little bit old in the ground with hair on them?
It does not matter.
Does it matter?
No, it's actually probably good.
It's probably good. It sweetens them in the fall.
We actually leave even some of the skin on as we're doing the dish because it has a little bit more of an earthy.
And so you grind
flavor.
In the old hand grinder?
Totally.
I'm coming right away for that. I want to taste. So how did you meet Danny Meyer in the first place? I mean, you were in California.
Yeah, you know, Danny Meyer came. I was at a restaurant called the Campton Place.
Oh, I loved Campton Place.
And I
used to stay in that hotel.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Right, when I
started going on book tours, so 1982 was my first book tour. And then in 1990-ish, I stayed at the Campton Place. And I stayed there until it kind of like lost its luster.
Yeah, definitely.
But it was such a lovely – and who was the original chef there? He was very famous at the time.
It was Bradley Ogden.
That's right. Bradley Ogden. Yeah. I loved him.
Yeah, yeah.
And where is he?
I don't know what happened to him. I know he opened a restaurant in Las Vegas at some point.
He was innovative food.
Definitely.
There. It was.
Yeah.
So that's where you went to the Campton Place.
Yeah, and he had a history of a few very successful American
Now that restaurant
chefs.
Was on a park also. On
yeah,
a square.
He was.
It was.
It was. It was.
Yeah.
But Danny Meyer ate there, and I was really brand new to America, and he ate there, and then 3 days later,
you got an offer.
He called, and I didn't know who he was. And then I said, "Who is Danny Meyer?" And then everyone was like, "Yeah, you should probably take that call." It was also interesting. He sort of had this opportunity of 11 Madison Park. And I said, "You know, I really love New York, and I could really see myself in New York. But in 3 days, we are actually going to get 4 stars. Which was the highest rating in the San Francisco Chronicle. So I told him that the timing might not be perfect because when you get this kind of award, you want to stay for a while and kind of show, you know, because then everyone is coming. And so you
were were you the chef at the time?
Yeah, I was the chef
were?
At the time.
Oh, so it's hard to leave.
Yeah. But then there was actually an ownership change in the hotel. It was a family owned and then a big chain kind of bought it. And then it all kind of worked out. I visited New York. I met with Danny. We walked through the space. I had the feeling that this could be one of the great restaurants in the world.
What did you learn from Danny Meyer, who is still very active in the restaurant world? He took his company public after he built a Shake Shack.
I mean, I learned so much from him. But I think one of the big things is he put language around what we are doing in restaurants, like the way we take care of people, the way we take care of ourselves. He just put language around all of it.
He made it more noble. He made it a very important industry.
I think that's right.
And he brought hospitality to that world, didn't he?
He made it something you would be proud of to be part of it.
Yeah. And you have continued in that tradition very nicely, I must say.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, really wonderfully. So where did you grow up? I mean, let's go back. I want to know a little bit more. I mean, you grew up in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Where?
I grew up in Zurich. I grew up with hippie parents. In fact, I grew up eating vegetarian very few times. Once in a while, we had like a chicken from some farm, but this was like twice a year kind of thing, but mostly vegetarian. But I also had kind of a difficult relationship with my parents. And I left home when I was 15 years old to become a professional cyclist. All I cared about was bicycle racing and winning bicycle races. And then when I was 22 years old, I had an accident.
Oh.
And biking and I...
Where? And in a race?
In a race. In Switzerland.
In the Alps?
In the Alps. And I ended up being in hospital for quite a long time. I was in a coma, actually.
Did your parents come to visit you?
They did come to visit me.
Oh, they knew.
Yes.
By that time, you were reunited?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
Yes. But I did not even, you know, and then growing up, I was this kind of weird kid that would bring the school lunch in a glass Tupperware, and there was, we only had home baked things, and I always felt like embarrassed towards the other kids who had like things from the grocery stores, right. And I wanted to have that, but I never did. But then I realized how lucky I was to develop this love for real food and real taste, and becoming a cyclist, what I ate became very important to me as well. And then when I had the accident, I left school when I was 14 years old, so I didn't
happened in the accident? Describe the hideous accident.
It was in a race, yeah. And we trained on the course. It was a mountain bike race, and we trained on the course the whole week leading up to it. But then in the race, I was at a very different speed, and I just, it was in a curve, and I thought I could take the curve at a high speed, and I just couldn't. And
you went down a cliff?
I went over the rocks. Thankfully, I didn't hit my head, but I had a lot of internal bleedings and a lot of broken bones,
oh,
and
boy.
I was airlifted. And
you would never know this from looking at the handsome Daniel Hume right now.
Yeah,
you look, and you walk very straight and very nice. So you're all better.
I'm all good, oh, good. And I'm definitely dedicated to that work. I'm practicing yoga almost every day, and I recommend it to everyone. I think if there's one activity you should do for the rest of your life, it should be along the lines of yoga or Pilates.
Yep.
I think it's beyond crucial.
Very important. Well, so at 23, you're...
So then I was in the hospital, and I'm like, I do have this love for food. And actually, you might know this restaurant, but it was a restaurant, Freddy Girardet. It was like outside.
I love Freddy Girardet. Yeah, oh my gosh. Well, I made pilgrimages to Freddy Girardet.
And this is actually where I went to go work.
Oh, really?
It was at that time the only three-star restaurant in Switzerland. And, he was...
extremely innovative
and
extremely beautiful food.
One of the founding fathers of like Nouvelle Cuisine.
Oh, yes.
What we know today as fine dining. And he loved cycling. So he was obsessed with cycling and the cycling culture. And we were there with our team when I was like 18 years old. And we had a big race. And on the way home, he actually invited our team. I was part of the Swiss national team. And he invited us to have dinner. And we had dinner in the kitchen.
Mm.
And it was the first time I saw a professional kitchen on that level. There were like 20 chefs.
And everyone impeccable.
Impeccable whites.
Oh, yeah.
Impeccable cleanliness. And they were working like it was a ballet. And there I felt like, wow, cooking on this level is kind of like a sport. And when I then was in the hospital, I'm like, I want to do that. And I called him, and it was on a Friday. And he said, can you start on Tuesday? And at that time, there was a waiting list, and people waited 2 years to get a job.
Oh, yeah. Interns, anybody.
He took me, and I made cooking my new sport. And it was about winning. And it was about working for the best, becoming the best. And then eventually it was about winning awards.
So then at 24 years old, you actually won a Michelin star.
Yeah. So 2 years after, I left Freddy Girardet, and I went to go work in this small inn in Switzerland. And I was only there for 4 months. And then I got a call from Michelin, and they said, well, they've been seeing what I'm doing. I'm going to get a Michelin star.
So and, exciting. What was the name of that restaurant?
It was called Gasthaus zum Gupf. Beautiful restaurant overlooking the Alps and the lakes. It was outside of St. Gallen. But, Marta, I was not ready for this at all. Like, I didn't know who I was as a chef. I didn't know who I was as a person. And all of a sudden, I got all this attention. Mm. That was quite difficult and overwhelming.
And how long did you stay at that restaurant?
I only stayed there 2 years also. And one day I got a call from a hotelier in San Francisco who happened to be Swiss. And he said, oh, he heard about my cooking, and I'm looking for a chef to move to America, and I would love for you to come. And in my head, it was like, oh, my God. Like, I never thought of America as like a culinary destination. And I didn't speak English at that time either.
Wow.
And so I said, this is probably not for me, but thank you. But he was very persistent, and he called again. And Eventually, he invited me to come to San Francisco to visit, all paid for, which at that point I was like, okay, I'm going to take that opportunity. And I remember...
And this was Campton Place?
This was Campton Place. And he was there. I remember so well, the hotel GM waited for me in his silver BMW at the airport when I arrived. And he took me right up to the Napa Valley. And we went to go see vineyards. We ate at the French Laundry. And then on the way back, we went to Chez Panisse. And then we saw the farmer's market at the ferry building. And within 4 days, I was sold.
Boy.
I saw an energy and an excitement for food and artisans and farming like I felt like I never saw before. And after I left, it was clear to me that I wanted to be in San Francisco.
Well, and then you accepted the job.
I accepted the
job. Did you have to go back to Switzerland and finish up some stuff?
Yeah, I went back to Switzerland. I finished my job there. I also had to get a visa. And I actually got a J-1 student visa for 1 year. And I came back on a Lufthansa flight. I didn't know that much about Campton Place, or I was just excited about the city. I was lucky because Campton Place had a history of all these well-known chefs. So people paid attention to what was happening there. And again, there, things happened so quickly. I got a James Beard Award within the first 6 months as like rising star chef. And this was actually the first time I moved to New York City. And again, I didn't speak English.
Did you learn? You're speaking so well now.
Well, just...
Did you take courses?
No courses. No? Just in the kitchen. Really? I never went to cooking school.
Oh.
I never taken English courses.
And are these the only two languages? Oh, no, you speak German.
I speak French,
of course,
German,
French, German,
and English.
And English,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. It's very, very impressive.
My path has been that, you know, I never finished even high school. So I think I learned a lot on the go, and it's been okay.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all 6 delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest
to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So you stayed at Campton Place for how long?
2 years.
Okay.
And then Danny Meyer came and I moved to New York because I felt that New York was the place to be. And 11 Madison Park, I've never seen a more beautiful restaurant. And I felt like I could stay there for a long time.
And did you come as the chef at that time?
I became as the chef and then had a business partner in the dining room.
That was Will?
That was Will.
Yes.
And then...
That's Will Gudera, everyone. You've heard, I hope, my podcast with Will. We had a nice conversation in this room. And he was so excited when you won the World's Best Restaurant Award. That was 2017?
Yeah, it was.
Wow. So
yeah, it was incredible, but it was mixed because for me, it was all about winning and I wanted to win every award and we won all the awards. And as we were going, I always understood intellectually that none of these awards are that meaningful, but what was meaningful, it was that it gave something to talk about with your team. It gave the team a direction. It's easy to understand. It's measurable too. And it does make the restaurant better and better and better. But the problem was as we won after the other, when we became the best restaurant in the world, there was not a single award that was left to win. And so it was actually quite disorienting. And I knew that there had to be something bigger.
You had to start thinking about reward.
100%.
That's what you have to think about. After awards, you think about the reward and the money and the financial success and getting everything and all your ducks in order, right?
And that's complicated
it's
too.
It's very complicated.
You know, and then
you were with Will for how long? Was he a very, very close partner?
We were super close. Uh-huh. I mean, we built so much together. I think we were very successful and powerful as long as we had the same goal. Mm-hmm. And I think we spent every day talking about how to become the best restaurant in the world. But we never talked about what happens when we become the best restaurant, but not for 5 minutes.
Right.
We just never talked about that.
So not about expansion, not about... You know.
We really didn't talk about that. And then the moment... we became the
How
best.
Did you celebrate when you won that award, the best restaurant? How did you guys celebrate?
I mean, we definitely always celebrated. We always have parties. And actually, Questlove, who is a friend of mine, came and DJed the party at 11 Madison Park. And when we became the best restaurant in the world, it was also right before, you know, we closed the restaurant for 8 months for a major renovation. And right before that, we had a huge party with Questlove, and he told me that this was the longest DJ set he's ever played.
Really?
I mean, he played till like 6 a.m.
Wow.
And it was a blast. And then we renovated the restaurant. And then I think we all sort of tried to figure out what the future looks like and where to go next, which wasn't an easy
answer. And what was
answer.
That, 2019 or something like that?
It was
that?
In 2018.
18.
Yeah.
And so is that when you split your partnership split up?
Yeah, so we decided to go different paths because we didn't see eye to eye anymore.
And personally, were you married? Were you single? What were the two of you doing personally?
Personally, Will was married, and I had been divorced for 5 years at that point. Mm-hmm. So I was single, yeah.
So you were totally business focused, or cooking focused.
The thing I'm trying to still find an answer for, but I am so focused on my work and it's truly the number one priority in my life. And it's what I think about when I get up and it's what I think about when I go to bed. And I really love what I do so much. But sometimes I wonder, you know, still how to find the balance in life. But maybe this is not exactly for this lifetime. Maybe in this lifetime, it's meant to be
Balance is very
about
hard.
Work.
Balance is very hard to find. I think women have more trouble finding balance than men have because men's careers are usually a life career and women change a lot.
Yeah.
But it is hard. Balance is extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And balancing a social life, a business life, a travel life, whatever. Oh, it's so hard. So so you dissolve the partnership.
Yeah, and then the pandemic hits. The pandemic was
the evil 2020. 2020.
It was devastating because if you think about it, it's almost every 10 years. So it was like 2001 and then
2001.
10 years later, the financial crisis and then pandemic. But the pandemic, we had 250 employees at that point. We had people from all over the world. And there was one night, I think it was March 16, 2020, when the city got shut down. And I remember our restaurant was full till the last day. Mm. And then we took the whole staff together and we said, hey, you know, the city's shutting down. We're probably going to see each other again in 2 weeks or so. That team has never been together ever since.
Wow.
I mean, we were close for almost 2 years, two entire years, no business.
And it didn't happen, yeah.
And, you know, in real estate, people talk about location, location, location. In restaurants, it's about people, people, people. So no matter how beautiful the restaurant, 11 Madison Park is, without its incredible people, it's just an empty shell. So that was really heartbreaking and we had to grapple around that. We're also facing extreme difficulties financially because if you have no business and you have rent and still costs, you can't pay it. So we're actually facing bankruptcy.
And were you the sole owner at the time?
At that time, I was the sole
owner. Wow.
Yeah. And I am a co-founder of an organization called Rethink Food. We take food from restaurants. We cook meals for people in need. And because of that, I was super tapped into what was going on around food insecurity in New York City. New York City has 8 million people. Before pandemic, there's 1 million people food insecure. Within the first 2 weeks of the pandemic,
you can just imagine
the number doubled.
2 million people.
It's 25% of New York City being food insecure.
Ugh.
And I'm not speaking about homeless people. These are people with 3 jobs, just having a hard time bringing food on the table.
Right. And kids. And yeah.
And so.
And kids at home who eat more at home because they're not
in school.
Meals, the school
that's
meals.
Right.
Yeah. Which they relied on.
That's
so
right.
Much. Yes.
So now I'm sitting here. Having lost my team, facing bankruptcy, which I don't wish anyone, but I knew I had a space, I knew I had access to some cooks, and I knew that the farmers are also sitting on food that's going bad. So I decided to turn 11 Madison Park into a community kitchen. And we brought a team back within the first 3 weeks of the pandemic. And we raised some money, and we just started cooking meals for people in need. And at the height, we cooked 8,000 meals every single day.
How great.
And that work changed my life because not only did we cook the meals, but we also went out into the neighborhoods. Like I went to neighborhoods and I've been living in New York for 20 years and I felt guilty, but I live in a very small sliver of New York City. And all of a sudden, I'm in parts of Brooklyn, in East New York, I'm in Harlem, I'm in Queens, I'm in all these places. And I'm also meeting amazing people, these amazing angels. There are people who are doing God's work, people who give everything, who have very little. And so not only, all of a sudden, I got up in the morning in the midst of the pandemic and I felt a happiness. I felt like I wanted to get up. I felt like my work, my cooking, for the first time in my life is actually making a difference. And so I knew that I had found something bigger. And during the pandemic, I wasn't sure if I ever wanted to open 11 Madison Park again. Because I felt like I brought what I wanted to do, become the best chef in the world. I feel like I did that. I didn't know what else there is to do. And the truth is, in the end, it made me feel empty, all the awards. And I did it for my ego. And my team's ego. And so during the pandemic, I realized that I wanted to do something that was more meaningful. And it had to be about giving back in some way. 6 months into the pandemic, the landlord called me, a big landlord in New York City, SL Green. They called me and I thought, oh, maybe they're going to kick me out and it's over. But they actually called and said, hey, we see what you're doing. We want to be in support, whatever it will
take.
That's
a very nice organization, by the way.
It was unbelievable. Yeah.
They've done so much for New York and the hospitality industry.
So they forgave all my rent.
Wow.
And when at that point, we still didn't know how long it would take to reopen or how long the pandemic would take. And when I put my creative hat back on, I knew that I had changed and I knew that I had no interest in reopening the same 11 Madison Park as before. And I felt the responsibility because 11 Madison Park is this creative platform. We push boundaries. And so in terms of creativity, I knew that the world did not need another version on a buttered poached lobster or on a steak or on our famous duck. But creativity had to go towards plant-based eating.
And so that's what you did. And I have tasted this delicious food. It is unusual.
Yeah.
It is curious in many ways, and it does not disappoint.
I mean, vegetables are so beautiful.
Oh, I love vegetables. As you can see, you walk through my vegetable garden. It's still productive, even almost November as we speak.
At first, we thought maybe this would be limiting because we leave all these things behind that we were known for and that we cooked for years.
Yeah.
But when I look back today, I feel like we were limited before. I feel like before we were just cooking seasonal condiments for fish and meat. And today I feel like we create the entire cuisine and what a main course could be.
So what are some of the other vegetable dishes besides the carrot tartare? what else are you serving?
Well, we started our own farm. Called Magic Farm in upstate New York, in Hoosick, New York, which has allowed us to, explore even deeper. So like, for example, in the summer, we are cooking sunflower hearts. And in fact, actually, we take the sunflowers, we harvest them right before they open up. So they're almost like little artichokes. So we work with sunflowers. We have a vegetable that's sort of like a Chinese lettuce, but it's called celtus.
Oh, yes.
And I love the roots.
I ate Mother's Day at the restaurant.
That's right.
And the menu was celtus.
Yes.
I think we had at least 5 courses with celtus.
Yeah.
And the children kept looking at it and saying, is this the same vegetable? It was very interesting. And celtus is like the heart of almost like a heart of a big fat escarole in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think that's right. And it tastes a little bit like, I would say it's a little bit between a cucumber and the celery, but it has also this like beautiful taste of like almost jasmine rice.
It has a moistness to it, yeah. Yeah. So you've figured out how to cook that in many ways.
But vegetables are really, truly limitless. And especially here in this region.
Are you using a centrifuge with your vegetables too? Do you use that?
We don't use that.
Oh, yeah. Because Nathan Merville taught me all about making like pea butter or carrot butter in a centrifuge.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, you put peas in there.
Uh-huh.
And what is left after it spins at, thousands of rotations a second or
uh-huh.
a minute,
uh-huh.
You're left with the essence of the pea. It tastes
emulsified.
It's like a butter.
Oh, amazing.
Because there's a lot of fat in a
pea. Amazing, yeah, of course.
And I bought one. I bought a centrifuge right away. You should experiment. Go. Have you visited Nathan's food lab?
I have visited.
Oh, don't you love it?
Unbelievable.
Oh, it's so so extraordinary. But I mean, to him too, vegetables are limitless.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah,
it is. Yeah. And that's the future, by the way. We have to
It's so beautiful. It's also so much healthier. You know, like even in the dining room, before it was like the energy in the dining room, it was like very high as people were starting their meals. And then by the time they got to the main course, it kind of like crashed and everyone was sort of like ready to roll out of the restaurant. And now the energy It escalates as the night goes on. It's unbelievable.
How great.
And I don't know if it's maybe because of the fermented foods, but it's also much more lighter. And people tell me all the time, like, people sleep so much better. They feel so much healthier. I mean, it has a lot of beautiful side effects beyond the delicious meal.
My daughter is raising her kids as vegetarians. Yeah. They eat a little bit of fish, but but monitored because of the iodine poisoning and stuff. But you recommend it highly.
Yeah, you know.
And as an athlete, how many athletes are vegetarians these days?
There are a lot of them.
Yeah. Runners and
runners, endurance athletes in general. I mean, there's football players, there's tennis players, I mean, all over.
So what kind of impact is the plant-based EMP having across the whole industry? What do you think?
You know, I do believe that doing this at the highest level, I understand it's not the most accessible because not everyone can eat at 11 Madison Park. But I do believe we have an important role in those establishments, sort of for leading the way. It's a little bit like in fashion. It's like the things that you see on a runway, you know, you end up seeing at Zara and H&M. And I think the same is true in restaurants. I think it does influence. For me, it was also about sort of like luxury. I think we need to value vegetables more. I think we still have this perception that a piece of meat is more valuable than a carrot or a celtus.
Well, it's getting to be more expensive, first of all.
For sure.
And fish, I mean, a halibut now at my local fishmonger is $45 a pound.
Yeah.
Who can afford that?
No. For me, this came as a reaction. I'm no climate expert or food systems expert, but I'm an expert in what I see coming to my kitchen in terms of ingredients. And Marta, I've seen such a dramatic change of, like, ingredients have completely disappeared. Certain ingredients used to be wild and now they're farmed. The way they taste has changed a lot. I mean, it's changing rapidly and we need to find new ways. And in terms of climate...
Do you miss any animal-based products?
I don't miss it at all.
Isn't that great?
I don't miss it at all. It's been so beautiful. And you know, this is not like...
And butter, do you cook with butter at all?
We make our own butter. We make a sunflower out of sunflower oil. We make our own butter.
What do you use for milk or cream?
We use different nut milks that we then ferment.
You make your own.
And so we make this beautiful fermented almond milk that's unbelievable. We make our own cultured butter. We make these beautiful stocks of all these different vegetables.
I love vegetable stock.
Yeah, it's so incredible.
When I peel my vegetables, it all goes into a rich, rich vegetable stock. I don't miss meat either when I'm not eating it.
No.
At all.
In terms of climate, and we're not anti-meat, but we are pro-planet, and in terms of for the betterment of the climate, the single most powerful thing an individual can do is to choose what's on your plate. And even if you eat vegetables like one day a week or 2 days a week, like, you don't need to go from all to nothing, but we need to adapt towards a more plant-based diet. And you could arrive there in many different ways. Like, you could arrive there for animal welfare. You could arrive there for farming practices. You could arrive there for health.
For pollution.
You could arrive there for climate. But the thing that you will not be able to escape is that we're actually running out of resources. There's a study that came out that I just read that said 80% of the farmland in the world is used for animal farming. Mm. It accounts for 11% of the calories. Mm. It's actually not an effective way to even feed the planet. In that same study, it said by 2050, we will need three planets to feed one planet.
The animals, to feed the animals that feed us.
Exactly.
Right.
So we cannot continue
the
way we are. And the good news is, vegetables are delicious, beautiful, healthier, and I think that's what we're here for to do.
Daniel had never come to my farm before, and you walk by the chicken coops.
Yeah, beautiful.
I mean, I have beautiful chickens.
Beautiful.
They lay beautiful eggs.
Beautiful.
The feed is atrociously expensive.
Yeah.
It's very expensive.
Yeah.
I value the eggs because they eat all the spent vegetables in the garden. I go to my vegetable market, don't tell anybody, but I get crates of trimmings of the cantaloupes and the melons and watermelons for the chickens, and they love eating all that.
Yeah.
They love it. And it does make better, tastier eggs. Right.
Yeah.
But indeed, the cost of raising the chickens does not pay for the money I could get if I sold the eggs. It just doesn't.
No, and it's also, I mean, this is a very romantic way of how you live up here.
I know, very romantic, but difficult.
The quantities we need, it all becomes industrial, and it's not realistic.
And I can't visit a factory farm. I can't. Yeah. I can't anymore.
Yeah.
I've read all about it. Where did you get your knowledge about it? Do you visit any of those factory farms?
I have visited some, and
it's quite horrible.
And you don't even need to dig that deep. Like, you see it very quickly, and it's really not something you really want to.
New York State, you see it.
100%.
Yeah. And the cruelty of raising animals in that way, too, is just horrific. I agree. And that's why, my diet's become less and less and less oriented towards meat products and much more toward vegetable.
You know, we read about the chickens have bird flu. That's a real thing. We read about the plastic in the ocean.
Yeah.
That is a real thing. We read about the Amazon burning because of cows and land. Mm. And we read about all the antibiotics that's in these animals. And the truth is, even if you're a small restaurant, let's say you have 40 guests and you need 40 chicken breasts. And that's a tiny restaurant. And that is 20 chickens.
It is.
And so just imagine, like, if a restaurant needs 20 chickens each day, now they need over 100 chicken a week. That already is no more a small farm.
No.
So it's just not realistic. This idyllic idea of like this little farm with the chicken coop is not a realistic one.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What are you serving for Thanksgiving?
This is another point, I think. We have the opportunity to change traditions. We can honor the old traditions and still somehow have them with us. But traditions actually need to evolve. And I know I love Thanksgiving. It's one of my favorite holidays. It's so beautiful.
The butternut squash is looking really good, isn't it?
Why do we eat turkey? Like, most people do actually not know why do we eat turkey. Most people don't even like turkey. Most turkey that's being served is anyway overcooked.
Yep.
And so 45 million turkeys are being slaughtered on Thanksgiving. Oh. Now, just where are they? I haven't seen a farm with like this kind of amounts of turkey. So I think we have the opportunity to change traditions and like a beautiful stuffed squash with stuffing and like braised in the oven. Mm. And you can still have all the cranberries and all the side dishes. And that's right. What we're serving. That's what we're doing at 11 Madison Park.
Yeah, it's admirable and also different and also healthier, and you are helping change tradition. You are.
Thank you.
So you start your farm. I have to come up and see your farm.
Yes.
How many acres of vegetables are you growing?
We farm on 6 acres. We have more acres, but today we're farming on 6 acres. We have 4 greenhouses. About 60% of all our vegetables are from our own farm.
Oh, great.
And it's been incredible because we can influence what vegetables we're growing. But then we also bring the compost that we have in the restaurant goes back to the farm. And so we created this kind of circular system that's also much more sustainable. And it's been just a beautiful path. And we're celebrating 25 years of the restaurant. But truthfully, I feel like we're at the very beginning. And it's so special to have this excitement for a restaurant that has been there 25 years. I mean, this restaurant has been my life, but today I feel more excited about it than I have ever before.
So how many other vegan or vegetarian restaurants are there in New York? Has the number increased over the last 10 years, would you say?
Definitely.
It has.
Definitely. I mean, it's definitely sprouting out and there's new ones all the time. And I think, you know, plant-based cooking isn't new. I think there's a lot of other cultures that have been doing this for many, many years. I mean, I was just in India, and of course, India, 40% of the population is vegetarian.
Exactly.
And you know, of course, all the Middle Eastern countries.
I thought it was more than 40%. It's only 40%.
It's 40%. Oh. Yeah. But that's a lot. I mean, in comparison to 1% in the U.S.,
Are we only 1%?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
What have you learned about cooking without animal products that would surprise us?
Well, I think one thing is like people always teach you or is being told how much protein we actually need. We actually don't need as much protein as people tell us. We actually need very little. And I think a lot of the protein can come with plant-based cooking from nuts and lentils and legumes and beans and so forth. And with that, I would recommend we actually use most nuts and most legumes that are all sprouted because it's much more healthier and your body takes it in much more. Cooking plant-based has also opened us up to the entire world as we're studying different cuisines like the Zen Buddhist cuisine in Japan or you know, all the Middle Eastern countries, which have this amazing, amazing, amazing cuisine. India, I was saying. But in a way, I feel much more free and much more opened to the world. It has also completely changed the audience that comes to our restaurant. Our audience is much younger today. Our audience is much more diverse. Our audience is much more thoughtful about the planet and not just about the indulgence of a luxurious meal.
So you have a restaurant in Las Vegas that we have that in common. I have a restaurant in Las Vegas.
Yeah, we had the Nomads, but actually right before the pandemic, we were able to sell it, and we ended that before.
It was a beautiful restaurant, by the way.
I loved it. It was great. Yeah.
I loved the library feeling in that restaurant.
Yeah.
The chef character in the TV show, The Bear, did he really work at 11 Madison Park?
No, he never worked at 11 Madison Park. But you know what? I actually just recently watched the show, and I think it's so well done. And I think the acting in it is really unbelievable. There's like in the first episode, in the first season, in like one of the later episodes.
The first season, that restaurant drove me crazy. It was so dirty, that restaurant.
But there is this monologue scene where he speaks about all the pain and the creativity that comes from that. And I think that definitely kind of hit home. I think the show is super well done. And
it is very well
there's
done.
There's definitely a lot of references on 11 Madison Park.
Well, what's your favorite part of running a restaurant, and what's your least favorite?
My favorite part about running a restaurant is all the people that we get to be around, the people I get to work with every single day, like the creativity. We get to do something creatively and collaboratively, and then we get to share that with all the beautiful people that come to experience it. I think there's so much life in that, and there's such a beauty in that. I think that would be my favorite part.
Can you reproduce 11 Madison Park, the vegan restaurant, elsewhere?
You know, I think we definitely want to bring plant-based eating into the world more than just with 11 Madison Park. 11 Madison Park, there's only one in the world, and there will always only be one in the world. I think it is so special, and we really have to protect it for what that is. It cannot be replicated, in my opinion. But there's definitely ways of, like, you know, creating a more casual version of a plant-based restaurant that is definitely interesting to me.
Well, this has been such an interesting conversation. I've learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners are just, they can't wait to try your food.
And Thank you, Martha.
I think they can't wait to learn more about plant-based eating and cooking. And you can get Chef Hume's new book, Eat More Plants. Describe the book for everyone.
So Eat More Plants was, in a way, never really meant to be a book, but I journal and I draw and I paint. And during the pandemic, I did a lot of that. And it was all around my ideas about reopening a plant-based restaurant and about painting and drawing vegetables and sort of like really seeing this come to life. And this is how my creative process works. And I got to meet this incredible publisher called Gerhard Steidl, who has published some of the greatest art books like Ed Ruscha or Richard Serra or Joseph Beuys or Ronnie Horn. Mm-hmm. And one day he came to the restaurant and he was very touched by the meal. And he asked me, what is my creative process? And I told him, well, I journal, I draw, I write. And then he asked me if he could see those drawings and journals. And he came the next day to my office and he looked at everything and he said, I would love to publish a book on those. And it was a very vulnerable thing because they're very intimate, and none of this was created to be ever seen by anyone. And so that was a process, you know, to get there. But then I've spent a few weeks with Gerhard in Göttingen, Germany, to create this book that today I'm very proud of. And it's a very intimate look into my creative process and the reimagination of 11 Madison.
I'd like to read this one little sentence. What the pandemic has taught me is that purpose brings happiness. Winning awards is important, but it's not everything. And that seems to be what you're living by right now. I mean, it's just incredible. And page after page in this beautiful book, I could frame almost every single one of these and have a wall of your art. This is very interesting and beautiful.
Thank you so much.
We have a unique platform at 11 Madison Park. It comes with a responsibility. Yeah. So your philosophy is here. And you must try very hard to visit 11 Madison Park when you're in New York City. Call far ahead for reservations.
Yes.
And bring a fat pocketbook because it's expensive. But I think you will enjoy the atmosphere. You'll enjoy the service. And most of all, you will enjoy a plant-based meal, the likes of which you have never tasted. So thank you, Chef Hume. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you so much, Marta. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.